You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, July 10th. Or in reality, Thursday, July 9th. But I am recording this for July 10th, really challenging the space-time continuum on today's Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Steeter. Sans or without Matt Binder, who's now a dad. Incredible news. Standing beside Noah, the great intern, archivologist, emerging market strategist, and vice president of regional development. Other titles we will just keep dispensing as his summer progresses. Today's program pre-record with Cliff Schechter and a woman, a really amazing person, Claudine André, who is an activist in the Congo working to save that country's bonobo population. And there is a new film that's been released about her work. We're going to be talking with her. We will be right back after this break with Cliff Schechter.
Yes, I wow. See, la CIA, give me the remedy, the fire figure burn. I said the papers turn. Give me the remedy, the fire figure blaze. Burn Babylon, dirty way. Eternal fire, dirty Babylon, you are gonna get bruised. Me, I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them bruised. Yeah. I'm back up and one. Me, I beg you move. Yeah. I beg you back up and one. Me said that movement alive. Marcus said we organize and centralize. Rastafi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting, my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me or your chant fire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire, dirty Babylon you want to get bruised. Me I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going lose.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. It is Casual Friday, and even though we were doing a Casual Friday on a Thursday, there are some things that simply can never change, and one of those things is the theme song for our guest. So let's have a listen.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
That's right, Cliff Schechter. Thanks for joining me, man.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Michael.
It's very good. It's always fun. So, Cliff, couple of things that we got to get to this week before we take off on vacation, and I think, or at least I take off on vacation. I don't think you're taking.
Sweet,
off.
Where are you headed, man?
You know, man, I'm just actually going up to Massachusetts to see family. The last couple of trips, I like went out of the country, which was great, but I need like an actual like lay around and do nothing vacation. So I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, well, those are fun too.
Oh, they really are. They're underrated. But it's actually, this is very fitting because this week, the uncharismatic brother of America's worst president, or a man who I say makes Mitt Romney look self-made. Jeb Bush came out and said, look, here's my economic growth strategy. Americans should work longer hours. Now, you know, I did a commentary on this for the Thursday show on just all of the sort of economic incoherence and moral perversion of this statement. But, it, you know, we should go into this more because it really is both demented and revealing. So, you know, tee off on that.
Should I start off with the demented or the revealing?
you pick your
poison.
Why
don't we do both?
Yeah, let's do both.
Look, you brought it up. In fact, he does make Mitt Romney look self-made because if you look at Mitt Romney, he was only a second-generation wealthy brat,
right.
Whereas Jeb at this point is a fourth-generation wealthy brat.
Right.
You know, Prescott Bush found his way around some of those trading with the enemy clauses to keep doing business in Germany. But that's a whole other conversation. Not to mention, actually,
he'll
I think
probably
it's
put in long hours, though. Yeah,
I think he worked hard out, hard in long hours doing that. I think it was a generation before him. Even I mean, look, this is a guy that you know his family members founded the famous firm Brown Brothers Harriman on Wall Street. They've been involved in Wall Street money, the national security state and defense money with the Carlyle Group, oil money. You know, whenever the state of play has shifted to the financial capital somewhere else, you'll find a member of the Bush family there, and that's fine. They have the right to do that. As long as they aren't breaking the law, they have the right to go and make their fortunes and as long as they do it in a legal way. The problem here is when these guys like Jeb Bush say things like he said and, you know, are so tone deaf and he walks around like he did anything or has ever worked hard in his life to make money. And I'm not even saying he's never worked hard on anything, but the vast amount of his wealth has been made since he left being governor of Florida. And, you know, he basically what he's done is he's traded on his name for a lot of easy gigs, you know, for setting up his private equity fund, hedge fund, to go and make speeches for the amounts of money that generally an average American family makes in a year or more. And that's what's so arrogant about it. And he didn't cash into the level that he did after his stint as a governor. But after his dad was elected president, I think even vice president, he was out there, you know, going and getting meetings and selling himself as the son. And everybody wants access. And, you know, people weren't saying, wow, we've got to have Jeb Bush on our team. We've got to bring Jeb Bush in here to be
that guy,
you know,
is really sharp.
Investor X or Monarch Y or whoever. He doesn't know hard work. And so it's just such an arrogant statement. And these guys, you know, the Republican Party base, which is largely made up of working class white men at this point, are the ones who deserve the blame for this because they let these guys get away with this. And how are they not offended by this? I mean, you know, again, I'm not for outlawing what Jeb Bush has done or Mitt Romney has done. I would regulate them heavily and make sure they're not screwing American workers. But if they're following the rules, then you can get rich in our economy. But to be so arrogant about it and act like that, you know, this is something that he did through hard work, which is what it seems like he's implying, as opposed to having the name Bush and knowing other people named Bush who could get in meetings with people, that's what's so ridiculous
with
about
meetings
it.
With people named Saud. But, you know, just to...
That was part of having the name Bush.
Right.
Was,
no, that's
was
what
getting
I'm saying.
A meeting with the Sauds, whatever the hell
Bush,
you want.
You can get a meeting through a Bush with a person named Saud. I was just
you even get to hold their hands and you get smoochies from them.
Right,
right.
It's
a good deal.
You can make out with those guys. But
most
I think,
other people in Saudi Arabia would be executed for that.
Yeah, there is a certain intimacy that I guess is allowed when you're dealing at that level. But it's okay. So it's not only morally perverse and tone deaf and probably something he'll take a whack for, you know, in the election. It's also like, could it be any more economically incoherent? I mean, look.
Well,
look
yeah, it's
at the,
also entirely
like
unrepresentative.
People are
of
out of the labor
situation.
Force because there literally is not enough work. People are already taking second and third jobs just to survive. So it's a complete economic non sequitur in addition to being
right.
morally grotesque.
Well, we've tried their way,
right?
Right. I mean, we've tried supply-side economics, and even though we broke with it somewhat during the Clinton years, a lot of it still remained intact. The sort of, you know, the conventional wisdom that deregulation always led to economic growth, the conventional wisdom that, you know, wealthy people create jobs and all this garbage kept going on, as opposed to, you know, the fact that it's middle class people when they spend money who create jobs. And when we have a vibrant middle class like we did the second half, or a large part of the second half of the 20th century, is when we had fantastic economic growth and the benefits that we had at that time. So, I mean, to sit here and think, you know, well, you know, if people just work harder, you know, we've got record corporate profits right now. It's not the lack of working hard. It's that corporate profits have gone up, and you know, our social contract has changed.
You talked about increasing productivity.
Go ahead.
Just to amplify.
Yes, productivity's gone through the roof. It used to be productivity
great.
Went up.
There's no issue.
Corporate
with productivity.
Profits went up. Wages right. went up. That's not the way it is anymore. They're right. not necessarily tied to each other.
Right. And he's talking about productivity. Like, that's ludicrous. I mean, because just to amplify what you're saying again, I mean, productivity is great. Productivity and corporate profits, bonanza, excellent. Wages are stagnant. Inequality is a defining crisis of our time, and it's amazing. I mean, it's just stunning. To not even pretend to understand the context people are operating in.
That's right. Remember, he's a common sense Republican. So it'll only get worse with the other guys who can't rub two brain cells together. What can you say? I can't say I'm surprised. I mean, of course Jeb Bush thinks this stuff. It's a sort of it's the raison d'etre largely, at least for being an economic Republican.
Right.
You know, there's the social side and other sides of that party. But if you're in the Republican establishment, you basically, you know, you think, you know, you were born on third base or at home plate after already having rounded, and you think that you did it yourself. That's pretty much the story of those guys.
Right. Where's my credit for hitting a home run? You know, I want to pivot off of this, because I actually think, you know, in the news this week, I mean, Greece is obviously a major story. I think it's pretty established what's happening in Greece, which is that austerity has destroyed Greece. And, you know, the Germans are maintaining a fanatical and inflexible position, which is undermining the European Union, undermining the European
very
project.
Unusual pose for Germany in the past.
We would like a more homogenous position. Yeah,
I couldn't help myself. Go ahead.
Yeah, the German jokes just—they don't even write themselves. Well, they do. They like speak themselves, because you want to do that that accent too. I'm not really sorry.
I could. I'm going to hold back. I could do my Arnold for a while, but you know, we'll. And you can easily work the Terminator jokes in there too, but we'll hold back on that for now and just say the austerity is ridiculous. You'd think Europe would have learned something in the manner in which you would have thought we would have learned something, not just from the Great Depression, but from smaller recessions since then, and from what didn't work starting in 2008. And they've starved this country to death. I mean, they've basically sort of beaten it senseless with this ridiculous austerity, you know, with not accepting that you need counter-cyclical spending and you need to goose the economy. And so I'm not sure what they think the end result's going to be here. If you're just more austere, somehow magic fairy dust will be sprinkled in the place and everything will get better. I'm not really sure what the Germans think is the end game, but I'm glad the Greeks are rejecting it. And right now they're rejecting the plan. I don't know where exactly they'll take them in terms of their involvement with the Eurozone. But, you know, if the Germans want to try to force this on them, then they should just get the hell out. This is ridiculous.
Exactly. Right. And we mean, part of where they're going to need to go is they're going to need, as a matter of practical survival, to talk to China, to talk to Russia, to look at other, economic and security arrangements. And I think that, you know, this is the bigger point that I really wanted to get to with this. And we'll get to China in a moment, because there's actually another parallel here. I mean, at this point, and it's very appropriate when we're talking about what Jeb Bush said this week and going into the 2016 election, and also going into, you know, holding people like Hillary Clinton accountable on really genuinely moving towards a sane economic policy. At this point, austerity is not – I mean, you look at happening in Greece – we have established that austerity is an economic failure. It's a, you know, it's a humanitarian disaster. And now legitimately you could say it is in some respects a threat to global and international security. I mean, you know, if the Eurozone crumbles, that might be a genuinely globally problematic thing. And at this point,
that's true. There are many potential repercussions.
There's serious repercussions. And you're playing, just as you said, this morality play on the Greeks. And that's exactly what the Republicans want to do here. And all of the evidence makes no difference.
Yeah, and it almost, in some ways, it reminds you somewhat of right in the post-World War II era when, you know, we were competing spheres of influence at that time with communist Russia, or at least they called themselves communists, call them whatever you want to call them, but let's call it authoritarian, the Soviet Union. Yeah. And where was the battlefield? A lot of it was not just Eastern Europe, it was Greece, it was some of these countries that, and you know, but instead of helping as we did back then with all sorts of loans and with, you know, investment in infrastructure, I mean, and I'm not just talking about us, I suppose we should talk about Western Europe, who's the main problem here. It seems like we're doing the opposite, you know, trying to push them away. And there's enough ancient animosities going on there. That you know, it's not that hard to push some countries in that region into somebody else's arms. And so it should be something that we should be, I think you're right, on a security level concerned about. And yet, you know, I don't know. We need some sort of German economic S&M to take place to make them feel better. I don't know.
You know, you held back, and then when you came out pretty strong.
Well, I just don't know what else to say about it. I can't believe we're doing this again. I guess it's just
shock. Absolutely. No, and I think, you know, again, the Chinese crisis, I mean, maybe it will blow over, but in some respects, I mean, that's even more frightening because the global consequences of China are, I mean, China's China. They're enormous. But it just seems to me, as I've weeded my way through it to some extent, and, you know, we can find another parallel here to Republican economics, which is that a big part of what's happening in China that's leading to instability on their stock market, and obviously it's not the only thing. I mean, China is obviously an incredibly long-lasting and, you know, and long-term civilization, but their stock market is pretty recent, and they're figuring out how they're going to design their system. But that said, I mean, they juked up a real estate market. And there was deregulation and speculation and crony capitalism. And again, here's another thing that starts to seem pretty familiar.
Yeah, I mean, China, I mean, that's authoritarian capitalism at its worst. I mean, crony capitalism at its worst. There's capitalism. It just only exists for the guys at the top. I mean, most of the wealthiest guys in the world are probably in the Chinese government. We probably have no idea how much money they actually have. They're the greediest, sickest. I mean, they've got billions upon billions of dollars. Their population is half starved. And so there's no actual real markets. Everything's distorted. They've had a kind of financialization of their economy in the same way the West has. But the difference is that as bad as we might like to complain about things here or even in Europe, as we're just discussing, there's at least some transparency. There's at least some democratic processes. There's something. It's certainly far from perfect, right? I mean, but what we decry here and in Europe is sort of the rule in China. I mean, you know, this in the end, I guess, shouldn't be a complete shock, you know? I can't say that I saw it coming. That I don't follow the Chinese market hugely, you know, really closely, only as close as I have to for certain other things. But that's, you know, and that's obviously hurting world markets, right? I mean, you throw Greece and China together and you've got a powder keg.
Yeah, that's a really – right, exactly. But I think the other interesting, you know, aspect to it is that China – you know, actually, you know, across the spectrum, we have an IMer who, you know, IMs this show, who is a very smart guy and sometimes calls. He's a European guy, European gentleman. I forget which country. But he sort of comes in with the, like, you know, wouldn't you agree that in some ways, you know, China operates more efficiently and China is, you know, delivering, you know, at least until recently, I mean, China has had pretty astonishing economic growth. I would argue if you're starting from such a low, you know, such a kind of underdeveloped baseline, you are going to have strong economic growth. But so that's on one extreme. But I would say even within the kind of Davos and Aspen Ideas Festival world and American discourse, I mean, there were people that romanticized India, and that was a kind of different thing. And then there were people that romanticized China. And there was a lot of talk of, you know, the Chinese efficiency, Chinese innovation, Chinese this, Chinese that. Obviously, there's an enormous amount of innovation and human capital and potential in China, but it seems like this is another example of our elite getting, frankly, kind of creepily misty-eyed over an insulated, plutocratic, politically unaccountable, as you say, crony capitalist system, and it's about to blow up in everybody's face again, even as it was being lauded in that world.
Yeah, you know, and again, I guess this is a show of looking at lessons never learned from austerity. I mean, we do this too, you know, go back to the 1980s and watch every movie where, like, you know, we're doing the same thing with Japan. Just right before they embarked upon their lost decade or decade and a half or so. Whoever it is who is sort of we look at economics, but we look at other fads and culture. It's almost like fashion. You know, you have a good couple of years or good, and suddenly everybody's like, oh my God, they can do nothing wrong. And we sort of, people, irrational exuberance, let's call it. And it's happened with our market too, obviously. I'm still waiting for Dow. What was it, 38,000 or whatever the jackass wrote? So, I mean,
what was that guy's name again? You remember that guy? What is his name? Oh, I can't remember his name, Cliff.
Glassman, Glasser,
something like that.
I mean, we're still waiting for that. You know, come on, buddy. Deliver. I think the same thing happened with China. You know, we bought the hype. But I've got no faith we'll learn from that. It'll be somebody else in like a year or two.
Right.
We'll buy, it's kind of like
Indonesia
we buy the hype
or
of
something, yeah.
Right, it's kind of like we buy the hype of terrorist groups. You know, Al-Qaeda was the baddest. Now ISIS is the baddest. We can't defeat. There'll be somebody else in a couple of years. You know, it seems like we've Kim Kardashian'd every aspect of our culture.
Except at least whatever is hot and interesting now.
Right? Whatever is cool and seems like it's working, even if it's destined for failure, we jump on that bandwagon. I don't know. I mean, I would hope we could foresee some of the problems that people that are paid to do this could see in a place like China or, in a future country. But I would be dishonest if I said I have a lot of faith.
Well, and also, you know, Cliff, right before we wrap up, I guess what I think you're absolutely right. And the only thing I would say in Kim Kardashian's defense is she never claimed to be anything she isn't. So maybe she's not even necessarily a bubble. She's just sort of like, you know, she's just, I don't know, she's like a fast food brand or something. She is what she says she is. But regardless of Kim Kardashian.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, but that's a really well-taken point. I think you're absolutely right about the kind of economics and economies treated as a fad and like fashion. I think that's 100% right. And I guess what I would add to it too, and I want your thoughts on as we move towards closing up, is – isn't it also, though, revealing about what certain aspects of elite opinion making, like what they're sort of fantasizing about? I mean, it's just very revealing when you look at China and it's like, sure, okay, they'll all acknowledge, of course, there's human rights abuses of China and, of course, there's problems. But, oh, man, these guys are efficient and they're empowering markets. I mean, you have libertarian people saying, oh, you know, China's less regulated than the U.S. It's like, yeah, well, in some respects, because they operate like industrial era, you know, sweatshops. They have like,
exactly.
You know, sort of like Blade Runner style air pollution. Yes, that's true.
There you go.
But isn't that very revealing, though, that even outside of those silly quarters, there was this sort of like, China, man, they really have it together. And it's like, well, if that's your image of having it together, I'm very concerned about what you want to do to our politics.
With the United States. Well, no doubt. You know, and I'm not saying it's the entire establishment. There are some progressive members.
Yeah, of course.
But largely it's a sort of centristy, center-right establishment that reveres sort of they don't like things to be dirty, you know, and to be unkempt and to not be sort of standardized and predictable. And I mean, so it was, you know, they've always sort of attacked the masses from the outside that would mess with what the pretty people, which in this case, I guess, is the smart people, you know, know better. And so they know better. They can be authoritarian and they should be able to take their bonuses and their, you know, their little crony capitalist gifts and sort of pocket extra because they're the masters of the universe and DC is their town or New York is their town or wherever you're talking about. And, you know, they're better than most people. And I really do think, again, I don't want to say everybody's that way, but a lot of people in those circles are that way. And so, yeah, in that way, they admire China. If you can look beyond the mass executions and all sorts of other things that are going on in China, then you can say, well, it is efficient because the smartest people and the best are the ones running the place, and they don't have to worry about appealing to the masses. Wouldn't it be great if we could all do that? Well, this is how it often ends up. Some other times it ends up in various different ways that are even worse, depending upon what leaders feel like doing to their own people. And you know, there's a reason why actually a bunch of rich elite guys a couple hundred years ago, while far from perfect and certainly didn't carry through on everything, favored some basic ideas about having a democracy and having some transparency, because this is the way these things end up.
Absolutely right. And let's hope this doesn't escalate in Greece or China, and that there'll be some restoration of people's well-being and some economic sanity. And, you know, we'll keep pushing for that. But, Cliff, I really
And the market comes back, because right. Otherwise your investments are going to be hurting, Mike.
Oh, absolutely.
Your generous majority report 401k. I don't want that thing to be getting crushed.
The money I make, that's actual money, is clearly not majority report related, but that's another conversation. Cliff, I really appreciate your time, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, everybody. Moving forward, we're going to be talking with a woman named Claudine André. She's a Belgian conservationist. And she runs an organization called Lola Ya Bonobo, and she works in the Democratic Republic of Congo on saving the bonobo population there. And there's been a documentary made about her work, and you know, it's a different flavor. It's a different type of Friday guest. It isn't, you know, coffee clutching about, oh, you know, one time Sarah Silverman and I had a coffee, or you know. Blah, blah, blah. I can't watch this movie. I'm too busy. I'm too tired. My back hurts. Or it isn't, you know, when Eminem have a Friday, and Matt usually takes over the film thing. And then it's like, yeah, I don't really care about your movie recommendation, Matthew. Have you seen Walking Dead? WWE. Walking Dead, WWE. Walking Dead, WWE. The Walking Dead's awesome. You know. That type of thing. So we'll have a little bit of a different conversation today. but give us 1 minute, and we will be back with Claudine André. And actually, the work she does really is fascinating. We'll be right back.
Turn my headphones up. It's pure. Nothing going to stop me now. Stillmatic. I'm here. Time to fight for you. You know? It's your world. Yeah, will y'all. Yo, all I need is one mic, one beat. One stage, one person front, my face on the front page. Only if I had one love, one girl and one crib, one God to show me how to do things his son did. Pure, like a cup of virgin blood, mixed with 151. One sip would probably make me flip. See my name in the hieroglyphs, like Osiris and Isis. Parables written inside papyruses, acknowledge it. We've been all tricked, time to come out of it. Seeds watch us, grow up and try to follow us. Police watch us, roll up and try knocking us. One knee I duck, could it be my time is up with my luck, I got up. The cop picking. Bus stop glass burst. A fiend drops a Heineken.
Ricky. Good afternoon, Wellington Hotel. We're running your service.
Blacking out as I duck back. Forget getting hit. This is my hood. I'm a rep to the death of it. To everybody, come on. Little brothers is grown. The rats don't abortion your wound. We need more warriors soon. Sit from the stars, sun and the moon. And it's like
okay.
The police,
yes, one moment.
Street sweepers and coppers. Sick of kids with no conscience. Leaving victims with doctors. If you really think you're gonna fly.
Hello?
All I need is one mic. That's all I need. All I need is one mic. All I need. All I need is one mic. Yeah. All I need is one cup, one page, and one pen, one prayer. Tell God, forgive me for one sin. Matter of fact, maybe more than one. Look back at all the hatred against me. Touch all of them. Jesus died at age 33. That's 33.
from 20 to 16 piece, that's 32, which means one of my thuns was holding 17. 27 hit your crew, 6 went into you. Everybody gotta die sometime. Hope your funeral never get caught up. Pain to go through the innocent, nothing is fair. Brothers roll up from wheelchairs, my heart is racing, tasting revenge in the air. I let this all slide for too many years, too many times now. I'm strapped with a couple of too many. If that people really with me, get busy, load up the do more than just hold it, explode the until you empty. There's nothing in our way. They boss, we boss, they rust, we rust. Try and feel it, I feel it in my gut that we take these dudes to war. Lie them down, cause we stronger now. My people's the time is now.
All I need is one mic.
One man, what I stand for speaks for itself. They don't understand and want to see me on top. Too egotistical, talking all that slick stuff, but my name is biblical. Wonder what my secrets is. Enemies move on you only if they know what your weaknesses I have. Not too late, I'm mad, young, I'm laughing, cause I'm a cool brother. Thought I wouldn't have that ass done. Fooled you brothers, what you call an infinite brawl, eternal souls clashing. War gets deep, some beef is everlasting, complete with thick scars. Brothers knifing each other up in prison yards. Drama, where does it start? You know the block was ill as a youngster. Every night it was like a or be killed. Body found in the dumpster. For real, a hustler. Purchased my brains. People throwing dirt on my name. Jealous cause fiends got their work and complain. Women.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Claudine Andre. She is the founder of Lola Ya Bonobo, and there is a new film that focuses on her work called Bonobos Back to the Wild. Claudine, thank you so much for joining us. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh. I'm Claudine Andre.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. Could you start by telling us what led you to the work you do with saving the bonobo population in the Congo?
Oh, it began during the war, of course, but I'm Congolese from long time. I arrived in Congo, I will tell you, 65 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I was there with my parents. My father was a vet there. And it's during the war that I begin to be involved with the bonobo. It's
and
just
the war is in the 1990s. We're talking about, just to be clear with our listeners, Mobutu Sese Seko left. He was a dictator who ran the Democratic Republic of Congo from the 1960s, I believe, to 1997. And then Congo, sort of the DRC, devolved into basically civil war in the 1990s that has kept on going through this day.
Yes, it was a very difficult transition period, and the army looting the towns, especially Kinshasa. And so my company with my husband was completely destroyed, but at the same moment, someone asked me, did you go to the zoo and see the situation there? So I never imagined the zoo can survive, an animal can survive in this kind of troubles. And okay, I pushed the door of the zoo, and my life changed. I remember I come back to my husband in his completely destroyed office, and he have one door as a desk, and I come back and I say, oh my God, we are so happy in this town, we have to do something for the zoo. And in 3 seconds, I see in his eyes, hey, why not? Because we have nothing left, even the house, even the company. And every day I go there, and finally I save the zoo and also try to manage a little bit the life of the men who are working in the zoo. And very quick, someone bring me a baby bonobo. I believe it was a chimp. And the director of the zoo told me, Mama Claudine, don't put your heart in this animal. It's not a chimpanzee. It's a bonobo. It was the first time I hear this word. And if they never survive in captivity, they are very, very fragile. It's a poor population in the zoo outside of Congo, and it's not so easy to keep them alive. So this one, of course, it was a second challenge for me. I want to save it. And I discover why he want to survive, because in my eyes, he sees some love, and he make a transfer of love on me, and he want to survive just for this. And this, it was the model. After this, I have 2, 3, 4, and then I begin to imagine that the people will never understand why I have this baby bonobo. Perhaps they can imagine I do this for money. So I make very quick a big contract with the Congolese authority, especially the wildlife and the Ministry of Environment. And we organize officially the confiscation of each orphan bonobo, because the law exists and they have to confiscate the baby bonobo. And it was the beginning of a big story who changed my life since really, 25 years now.
That's an amazing story. And really briefly, you said that there was this emotional connection with the bonobo. And I think it's important and interesting for the audience to understand. Bonobos are very, I mean, all animals, obviously, all like chimpanzees, all animals in that family are very close to humans genetically. But bonobos have a very particular sort of emotional sensitivity or emotional life. They're very connective animals. So tell us a little bit about what makes bonobos sort of so sensitive to that type of connection. What the kind of distinct attributes of bonobos?
But you know, the first thing with the bonobo is the eyes. When you look in the eyes of a chimpanzee, he tries to escape out of your eyes every second. It doesn't like it really. He's interesting, he comes back, but he doesn't want really to be very close of you. The gorilla ate this. But the bonobo, when he look in your eyes, he go deeply in your eyes, perhaps to see your soul, is very, very different. But you know, the bonobo is different because the social organization they have. It's not a male with a territory and with his females and kids. Bonobos is the female, an alliance of female who manage the male and the aggressivity of male. So they are smaller than the male, but when they are together, then they manage this. And how they can be the boss? With sex is a way, is a language of peace. It's not only sex. They are the sexy chimp, but not
so
only
they're like
for
hippies.
Sex.
They're like hippies, except better than human hippies, because a lot of human hippies, let's face facts, they're not so great. But bonobos are like the real hippies, and they're actually very cool.
Yeah, they are very cool. They are more peaceful than chimpanzees. It's a part of our behavior also, but just a part.
Right.
We can be also terrible chimps.
Right. Right, right. We're trying to evolve from chimp to bonobo. That seems to be my understanding as I listen to you. So this work began 25 years ago.
Yeah.
How has it expanded? And now when we get to the film, the documentary Bonobos Back to the Wild, what does that film chronicle in terms of the work that you're doing with bonobos now, and how that work has grown over the last 25 years?
Oh, of course, the war continues, and we have several wars, so I have to adapt my projection of the future with the political situation of Congo. First, when I have 11 bonobo, I have no place to go, and the American ambassador and the director of the American school in Kinshasa offered me for several months to go in the campus, and it was for me fantastic because I begin my education program for the youth. And I have to stay several months, but I stay 5 years because the school was closed. And just when we sign all the paper for peace and Congo begin to go out of really war, especially in West Congo, not in East Congo, I find a very nice forest area, Lolaya Bonobo, and we moved there with 20 bonobo, and now we have 75 bonobo. And in 2005, Lola began to be a little bit saturated because the orphan of the bush meat trade. You know, the Congolese kill the bonobo like the other wildlife. And the baby are take like a pet they try to sell. And we confiscate. And in 2005, I imagine that one day I have to refuse the last orphan of the last great apes bonobo. So I can imagine this. So I begin a new step in this project. It's to reintroduce the bonobo in the wild. And in 2009 and 11, we reintroduced bonobo. And probably next year, if I have the chance to collect the money, we will reintroduce a new group in a big area. It's a communitary forest. We work with the local human population. It's very important. It's 80% of the project is the connection and sensibilization of the local population.
So in terms of threats to the bonobos, is that, so I understand that some people, that there's a trade in the same way other chimps are killed and I guess used for poaching or for fur or, you know, pets or all of these other kind of, these abuses that we're very familiar with, and that's, there's nothing distinct about Congo in that regard. I mean, this is a global problem. But is there also a specific threat from different military or those factions or
no?
Yeah, no. Okay.
No. Is any difference between what we live in Congo? Okay, we are in war in east of Congo, but the large part of the country now is not in war.
Right.
But we have the same problem than even Kenya and South Africa. Everywhere the species disappear, and especially since 2010 is more and more. I don't see any difference. They often continue to arrive because the parents are killed in the wild, and elephants are killed for ivory.
Right.
Rhino are killed for the horns. And it's everywhere. I think Central Africa, but it's not only Central Africa, the same problem also for the orangutan in Asia. It's a bad period for biodiversity. Humans are everywhere, perhaps, and too much. But, you know, we have to have a hope because humans, of course, they go everywhere on the planet. They destroy everything. But since today, we have to think also that they are the only animals, sorry to say animals for human, but he's the only one who is able to know why he destroyed the planet, but it will be also the only one who can find a solution, perhaps.
If not, my God, that's right. So as we move towards ending our conversation, is there anything, the film is Bonobo's Back to the Wild, and the project is Lolaya Bonobo. What could people do now? I mean, I'm sitting here in New York City. People are listening to this program across the United States, but also in Australia, Europe. What can people do immediately other than see this film and support this film and maybe support Lolaya Bonobo? But what can they do to help this endangered population?
It's difficult to say. Send money to the program. All the conservation are made everywhere, but it's the only way for the moment. We are on the ground, and we try to make sensibilization, education to the local community. They have to understand everything is connected on the planet, and they can share the land. They can respect biodiversity. But bushmeat is a big problem. It's a mix of things. It's why we cannot find the solution. It's a mix of tradition, poverty. They want to have money by themselves. And so people arrive from the town, they give bullets to the villagers, they go, they kill the animal, every animal. And they smoke the meat and they bring the meat to the big town, and sometimes even they export. It's just for money. It's just for money.
Mm-hmm. So we need to find,
When we are there, Kinshasa, we receive 30,000 kids in Lolaya Bonobo, because it's my hope, the youth. My motto is conservation begin by education, because the future is them, the kids. And in the wild, it's very different. We have the release site, it's 1,000 kilometers from Kinshasa. We have to organize the local communities in committee of development of village. We have to support the poor school, the bamboo school, like we said. We bring just book for the teachers. We give some comfort to the mom in the four maternities around the reserve with some medicine, with solar lamps. We organize them in local little NGOs for fishers and agriculture to have an alternative on the bushmeat. So, yes, we need money to organize this. Sorry to be so rude to say this, but it's not another way. We are 22,000 kilometers from the public here, and what we need to help this to continue the combat, it's believe in us. We are there. I am a Mwanamboka, like the Congolese say. It's a girl from the village. It's my country, and I know the way to be near the local population, because you have understand everything in Africa. Law, it's one, but population is so important also. So we have to understand things and make big trees with the problem, speak with them and say, okay, this year, what do you want? We work like this, years by years.
Well, first of all, Claudine Andre, there's nothing to worry about with being rude in a New York-dominated audience. That's quite okay. We welcome it. The work is beautiful, and I think that what you're also saying that's very important is obviously you can't have a real strategy for conservation without a strategy for human rights, for dealing with poverty, for development. All of these things are connected and integrated, and I appreciate that you work that way. The work is beautiful. The film is Bonobo, Back to the Wild. The project is Lola Ya Bonobo. We'll have links to all of these things on our website at majority.fm. Claudine, yeah. Andre, I appreciate your time and your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you for you. Thank you for all my staff and the program we are doing in DRC. Thank you.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. So that's it. The pre-record Thursday is over, and it's Friday. It's Thursday. It's past 4 o'clock. I've been talking all day. I'm exhausted. I'm tired. My day doesn't quite stop. I have some more to do. Tomorrow, while you're listening to this, I'll probably be taking a nap. I might be at one of those yoga classes. Maybe even having a glass of wine. You know, I really don't drink that much wine, which is why I think that's such a great, it's a great bit. Everybody, we're going to have new shows for you next week while we're on vacation. Thanks a lot, Noah. I think this went great today. I appreciate it. And we will be back live on Monday the 20th. All right, everybody. Take care. Bye. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want.
but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and